Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. The next topic we want to cover on sound optometry is brain tumours. A brain tumour is an abnormal growth or mass of cells in or around the brain. They can come in various shapes, sizes and locations, and they can affect anyone at any age. Brain tumours can cause a range of cognitive and motor problems, from difficulties with memory and language to mobility issues. For many people, they are life-threatening, and their incidence is increasing in the UK, particularly as the population gets older. Most people who have brain tumours display signs and symptoms. In fact, around a third of people affected by a brain tumour report a problem with their vision. That's why optometrists are uniquely placed to catch suspicious signs early and refer patients into the hospital for further checks. You could end up saving a life. So, on the sound optometry team, we went down our usual route of finding an expert and a case study to illustrate all of this. But after doing the interviews, we decided that it's worth spending a little longer on this topic, so the next two episodes will be focused on brain tumours. In September, after the summer break, we'll hear from Lorcan Butler, a specialist optometrist with the Brain Tumour Charity. Lorcan will explain what to look out for and the further tests to do during eye examinations. But today, we'll hear the case study. And the reason why we're dedicating a whole episode to this is because Connor McCann has quite a different story to tell. You see, Connor is an optometrist. Over the last few years, he's undergone huge personal and professional changes, which meant that he and his colleagues have had to overcome a range of unexpected challenges. Connor's condition was a particularly serious one, but there's lessons that everyone can take from it, regardless of what the underlying condition actually is. And the story is undoubtedly one we can all relate to and connect with.
This all began at the tail end of 2022, actually. It was a dark winter's evening. I was just finishing up with a late night clinic and began my journey home. And for some reason, I was inclined to take a scooter home. I don't know why, but an electric scooter was involved. And I was coming home and I got struck by a car. I managed to get to relative safety off the pavement. I was aware that I'd hurt my foot or my leg, and I kind of realized that I wanted to look back towards the car, but I wasn't able to. I began to get a warm sensation in my mouth, and basically I realized that I had bitten my tongue, and my last thoughts were I was having a seizure, and the footpath came up to meet me, and the next thing I was in the back of an ambulance.
So what happened when you actually got to the hospital? Can you remember?
Yeah, so I was ran through a head CT and blood and so on, and they presented me with good news and bad news. The good news is it wasn't any internal bleeding or hemorrhaging or whatever, but the bad news is that I was likely to have a brain tumour that had been growing silently away for God knows how long.
Connor's journey also reminds us of the indiscriminatory and often invisible nature of brain tumours, how unconventional the diagnosis can be, and how to be resilient despite the profound impact that they can have. And he wants us all to get better at seeing and feeling things from the patient's perspective. So let's go ahead and hear his story.
My name is Connor McCann, and I'm a UK practicing optometrist. I'm 35 years old. I've been diagnosed with an astrocytoma grade 2. That's a type of brain tumour that's moderately severe. The worst type of brain tumour, the least good prognosis is the glioblastomas, and my one is somewhere below that. Yeah.
So before that episode, did you have any inkling that there was anything wrong, any signs or symptoms?
No, not at all, Michelle, which is very unlike most brain tumours. Most of them present sort of with seizures or with numbness or tingling. Mine didn't have any of that, so I consider myself very lucky to got a jump on that. and to find it earlier than it would have normally presented.
It just actually shows your very positive outlook that you see your accident as a lucky coincidence that helped you discover the tumour.
Exactly.
I think that's the thing with brain tumours. In practice, we're always told that people present with these symptoms and this is what you should ask them. But actually, brain tumours can develop very slowly. And sometimes the symptoms are so innocuous. You think, actually, is it just that I'm tired? Is it just that I'm stressed? Is it? You make excuses, don't you?
Yep, absolutely.
Did you have any signs, ophthalmic signs at all, that you had a brain tumour? So typically in practice, we look for things like optic nerve issues like papilledema.
No clinical signs whatsoever. So no drop in VA, no optic neuritis, no swollen optic nerve heads, nothing.
So that's not what I would have expected from my experience in practice, where we expect to pick up ophthalmological signs before other signs of brain tumour might reveal themselves.
Yeah, so actually, in my practice, I had a case of what turned out to be a brain tumour. It was dropping VA, swollen optic nerve heads, and I had the conversation of what this could represent, and let's get you an opinion down at the day hospital today. And that did turn out to be papilledema, and a result of a tumour on the, I think it was the optic chiasm, actually. So it was interesting for me to be having that conversation on the other side.
Yeah. So at the time, what did you understand about your condition?
What I understood about my condition is not all brain tumours are the same. There's a lot of types of brain tumours, and they vary in aggressiveness as well. So my tumour actually is described as has moderately favourable characteristics. That's a kind of a good way to describe it. There's better tumours to have and there's worse tumours to have. So I was kind of in the middle. And so the thing I took away from that conversation with my consultant at the time was, this isn't a death sentence, so to speak, right? You know, this is not going to kill me within a year. But actually, the kind of thing I wanted to get from him was actually, whereabouts was my tumour in terms of survivability?
And that's a very difficult question to ask, because you're almost scared to hear the answer.
Yes.
And it's very difficult for them to give you an answer, because everybody is different. Mm-hmm. And I think although you've been very brave and said, well, yours is a lower grade, I'm quite lucky it wasn't the severe grade, but actually any tumour is terrifying.
Yeah, indeed.
So what did you understand the prognosis to be eventually before you, you know, before they decided on a treatment plan for you?
I did ask the question, actually, to the consultant that you never should ask, you know, but they give me a kind of fairly pessimistic viewpoint. I was given sort of 5 years, but a lot of the research is fairly out of date, and this is the mean survivability. So with the research being out of date, and there's a lot of things that can be done, you know, like, what am I trying to say? Like, a lot of things that can be done better.
Treatment-wise.
Yeah, treatment-wise.
It's advanced a lot in recent years, hasn't it?
Yeah. So, and the mean survivability is not a kind of good estimate of this. So I did ask a question, and I got my answer. But actually, I regularly see people have been diagnosed with these on internet forums and so on, and they just keep kicking.
Yeah.
They regularly get past 15 years. So I think I'll be around for a bit yet.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Yeah. So we've just talked about your prognosis. So you're about to start your treatment. What was the initial round of treatment like?
It was suggested that I remove as much of the tumour as possible through an awake craniotomy. And an awake craniotomy involves basically knocking the patient out initially and then actually bringing the patient back for testing, because my tumour was on the close to Broca's area, which is quite important for speech. And they were worried about my communication abilities, especially as an optometrist as well. They wanted to make sure that my speech was unaffected, and also the motor control as well.
So, sorry, I'm just getting quite upset listening to your story, actually.
Don't worry.
Okay, so having been terrified that you've got a tumour, you now have to go through this really frightening experience of actually being awake while they're doing the surgery. It just sounds like a nightmare. How long did the surgery last for?
So the surgery lasted for 6.5 hours, and I'm getting emotional now in response to you. But yeah, so I was operated on in Bristol. I had a speech therapist nearby in the room. I had a physio nearby in the room. I had a nursing crew. It was very, very strange. The closest thing I can describe to it was feeling like I was in the dentist. But you're able to chat to the people operating on you. Yeah. So I was telling them all about my holiday and he was telling me about his holiday, and it was very surreal. And in the background, every time they took more tumor away, I could hear these kind of sounds. And then every so often they would test me for my motor control. So they would send an electric shock down my my right-hand side. And then I would do some more word exercises. So the test that they used was identifying like verbs and so on, and like saying things in response to it. And that was done by the speech therapist that was present in the room.
So it sounds like their surgery was absolutely meticulous, and they're sort of inching their way and then retesting, inching a little bit more, or maybe probably less than inching actually, and then doing a bit more. So it just goes to show how delicate the area of the, well, the whole of the brain is.
Yeah, it's so true. And at some stage I had difficulties with my speech. They decided that they couldn't take any more out. So I understand that the tumour is like an oil drop in water. It's called a diffuse tumour, my one. So the healthy brain tissue was kind of in amongst the actual unhealthy brain tissue. So that made it incredibly hard for the surgeons to actually take out in completion.
So you know that they couldn't take all of the tumour. So what was the next stage?
The next stage was very difficult for me to actually decide upon, because I had the choice of doing active surveillance on one hand or treating it with radio or chemo on the other hand. Because I'm 35 years old, it was a difficult choice, because radio and chemo does come with consequences, reproductively and other ones as well. So I decided to forgo radio and chemo for as long as possible. And I think that was a good choice at the time.
Was your decision influenced by how you felt after the surgery? For example, your recovery, how well you regained your speech and so on?
Yeah, so that's a good point, actually. For about 2 months, I was only able to speak in broken sentences, and some of the motor control was affected as well in my right hand. My Volkshand is, as we say, but that came back shortly after the swelling in my brain went down. So I would say it was a fairly swift recovery. I managed to come back to practice again 12 months after the actual surgery, but the MRIs were quite good subsequently and didn't show any regrowth. So I decided to actually forego the radio and chemo to put it off for as long as possible. So I effectively go on active surveillance. It was a difficult decision, but I think that was the right one for me at the time.
Mm. And when you went back to work, did you notice any change in your behaviour as a result of your condition? Did you have to adapt what you did?
Behaviour change? I would say I don't think so. I think I'm aware that the tumours, particularly in the area that mine was in, can actually decrease impulse control and also affect mood and so on. But I was lucky that my mood's always been quite good, and I'm not aware of any changes with that. But it certainly changed how I went about my practice. So before, my character was quite easygoing, and I was able to...
You were more able to go with the flow then, do you think?
Yeah, exactly. And so I implemented a lot of cheat sheets and so on, and sort of cues and so on. And actually, the social battery was the hardest thing, because I would usually like to have a chat with my patients and build a rapport. And that's why my patients came back to me time and time again. However, I kind of had to pull back a little bit from my patients to preserve some of that social battery.
And in terms of the staff that were around you at work that supported you, I mean, it must have been a difficult time for them as well, you know, interacting with you, not knowing how you were and how they had to adapt to your new working style as well. How did that go?
A lot of this happened without me knowing it. So I'm part of quite a small business in Bristol. So they were able to handle my condition very, very well. And I don't think I anticipated how emotional the staff would have got, because they'd obviously built a rapport with me. I've been working with the company for 11 years.
Mm.
And the staff were trained in sort of what to do during a seizure, because I'm now epileptic as a result of my surgery. And so I usually have a seizure every 2 weeks. And it's a focal seizure that I normally get. So my head and my neck go up. And it's quite scary to witness, actually, but I'm fully awake, fully conscious. However, the staff needed to be trained in what to do during a seizure. And from a HR perspective, they had all signed documents that they were happy to help me out in the event of a seizure. Mm. I only did have one seizure, and it was what I call a mini seizure. And thankfully, there wasn't a patient in the room. So we had a protocol for that as well.
Yeah.
However, it was just around a colleague, and I just said, oh, can you stay with me for a minute?
Mm.
Thankfully, it didn't progress. My seizures typically start with nystagmus, mm. and then sometimes a little facial twitch. I'll know then if it's progressing, and I'll get a full seizure or I'll not.
Mm. But on a more personal level, do you think having this tumour and the experiences that you've gone through has changed the way you live your life now?
Yeah, so definitely, Michelle, it has definitely affected my perspectives on life. There was a time that I was very career orientated. It was all about work and work and work and what I was going to be doing. What's the 5-year plan going to be doing? And fortunately, I'm feeling really, really good in myself at the minute. I'm feeling really healthy in myself, both mentally and physically. And I'm living for the moment. I think that's the biggest impact that it's had on my life. Pushing yourself outside your comfort zone. You know, the fact that I'm here on podcast with you today, you know, even before my brain tumor, would have been kind of uncomfortable for me at the best of times. However, I maybe have a little bit less confidence in my public speaking. And actually, I think that the best way to deal with this is a proactive attitude, and hopefully that comes across.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely does.
So I think, yeah, it's changed my complete perspectives, and I'm feeling very, very good at the minute.
And that's it, isn't it, really? It's about enjoying life as it comes and not putting off what you can do today.
In many ways, I feel in a better position, actually, Michelle, than I was before diagnosis, because I've become a lot more healthy. I've got a good morning routine. I've lost a lot of weight, actually, and it's really shown how important love and compassion is as well. So I've had lots of support from my friends and family. I've a wonderful partner called Jessie that's been an absolute rock to me. You always see the best in people when things like this happen, I think, in the surroundings. So it's brought a lot of love into my life that maybe wasn't visible or wasn't there perhaps before.
Well, it certainly wasn't as visible as it is to you now anyway. So it's having that knowledge that you are loved and that you're cared for.
Yep.
And you're supported. And not just by your nearest and dearest. It sounds like your colleagues are doing it for you at work as well.
Yes, that's it.
I mean, you're now 3 years since your initial discovery of the tumour. You went under active surveillance. So are you undergoing any treatment now?
Yeah, so I'm actually week 5 into radiotherapy now. So I've lost the hair. This isn't a good hairstyle for the summer, but it's going to be soon followed with chemotherapy. So radiotherapy tends to last 6 weeks, and then chemotherapy tends to last, I think, 36 weeks. So what I know about chemotherapy is week 1 is the worst, and the further 5 weeks are less bad, I've been told. But I expect to be able to return to work to some degree at that stage.
So it does sound like it's going to be a bit of a long distance run in terms of treatment. But I think you can see the finish line, can't you? Which I think is really positive. In terms of optometrists that are listening right now, what do you want optometrists to know about brain tumours? What is the key message that you think you want to get across?
It's a really good question. I think the initial answer is brain tumours are obviously very important to get your diagnosis right. And if you ever see anything that's suspicious of a brain tumour, absolutely refer into the eye hospital or indeed the A&E. However, they're not a life sentence.
Yes.
It's really, really important. And I want to shed a light on what people can achieve and do when you know you have a brain tumor, but actually you may struggle with one thing or another. But when you've had the appropriate treatment, you're just like not waiting to die. Mm. It's actually, there's so many positive things that can come out of it.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those conditions where we're, as optometrists, we are terrified of finding.
Yep.
And because we don't like breaking bad news. And I think having you come onto the podcast and explain that actually the prognosis is often much better than you might have thought it would be, it might actually give optometrists more confidence and make them feel less scared about broaching the subject with their patients. And also hearing your experience will give them more compassion when dealing with patients so that they can communicate more effectively in their role.
Absolutely, Michelle. The thing that I remember the most about my experience down in the A&E department was when I was brought in to deliver the bad news, so to speak, I could tell, you know, the non-verbal cues, what was going to happen. I was going to be given some sort of diagnosis that was not good. And actually, it kind of made me think actually how I deliver bad news. And I've seen a few cases of various things in the interim time when I did return to work. And actually, it's changed my behavior a wee bit towards them. And basically, I lead with empathy and compassion, as I'm sure that you do as well. And actually, I think that it's very, very important to just see the human side of the patient as well.
Mm.
Because when I diagnosed papilledema, which eventually ended up to be a brain tumor, I was just thinking, oh my God, like I was thinking very internally what this meant for me. And obviously the patient is in a totally different world and probably won't remember anything that you're saying. So
yeah, that's it. Yep. That's it. And I think that's really important, actually. When you discover something like that in practice, you're thinking about the impact on you. You almost, it is important to remember that actually you've really got to make sure that the patient is okay.
Yeah.
Because I think news like that is quite shocking. And I think even if it's a case of actually, if you've just delivered bad news, how do you make sure that patient is okay leaving your practice? It's things like, will they be able to get home? Is there someone that you can call for them? It's the extras, isn't it, that shows that compassion?
Yeah. Warm drinks always help.
Yes. So how are you feeling about the future now?
I feel very optimistic about the future. Hopefully that comes across as well. But I kind of like to envisage a time that I get back to at least 3 days or 4 days of practice full time and maybe sort of branching off to a parallel sphere eventually. Maybe that'll be in teaching or business or whatever, or professional services than optometry, because the secret, my biggest fear is that one day the tumor might progress and might make my communication not possible or my motor skills. So I kind of have to put my eggs in
more than one basket.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah,
and it's given me this wonderful opportunity to actually consider a lot of other spheres of optometry or potentially other things completely.
Yes.
And from a personal level, actually, it just has really, really highlighted that actually life's not to be taken for granted. You'll get one shot at this and actually do what you want when you want to do it, not put things off, you know.
Yeah. And actually, even from a work perspective, optometry, it can be very diverse if you go looking for it. So good luck in all your endeavours going forward. Connor, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Michelle.
And thank you for listening. You can follow Connor's journey through treatment and recovery on his blog called I Am Connor. We've put a link to it in the podcast description. Also, if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. Remember that if you go on to complete the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering communication and professionalism. We'll be taking a month off now for the summer, but we'll be back in September when we'll hear from optometrist Lorcan Butler about the ocular signs and symptoms of brain tumours.
There is a big link between eyes and brain tumours, and that can be blurry vision, double vision, damage to their peripheral vision, and they may not be aware of it. But not all brain tumours can be detected in eye examination, so as optometrists, we need to be able to be aware that not everybody presenting to a practice will be the typical person who has vision problems. And that's where we need to have a very thorough history and symptoms to pick up underlying conditions that maybe aren't necessarily eye-related. Somebody maybe says a change, a gain in weight, which can be linked with idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Somebody's partner saying that they're sleeping an awful lot more. So we need to be aware of this factor too.
Make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss that episode. It's full of valuable tips for us all to improve our practice. That's all from us. We hope you have a wonderful summer. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.